19. Probably won't really reference the handout other than just to mention that we're still in, or Paul is in that matter. He's still in Ephesus. So, if you happen to have the handout, that's fine. But we're going to turn to Acts 19, 21 through 41 tonight. Seems like a lot of verses, but Acts 19, 21 through 41, it's all narrative text. It's a story here, and it goes pretty quickly. Acts 19, 21 through 41. This is part four. Taking notes. Before I give you the outline, tonight one of the things to think of when we look at this is to see how the Lord directs Paul's plans. Paul yields to him, but God also delivers him, but he's going to deliver him, Paul that is, by using, we might say, some unexpected means, an unexpected person. And of course, the Lord does the same thing today, doesn't he? He guides us. He directs us by his Spirit. We're supposed to, of course, yield to the Spirit and what he has for us, but he also delivers us. And sometimes God does send some peculiar or unusual means by which he delivers us. And we'll see that in the story tonight. Because again, God does deliver, but sometimes he chooses to use some unexpected, in this case, individuals. So the outline that we're going to have for tonight, if you're taking notes, we'll look at verses 21 through 22, the mission the Lord directs. And what this is doing when we go to read it in a few minutes, again, the mission the Lord directs, 21 through 22. Basically, when we look at this, what Luke is doing is Luke is providing the path of the route to get us to Acts chapter 28. So more specifically, what Luke does is he shows that Paul will go to Jerusalem and then to Rome, which is basically the rest of the book. So what we'll see is, as we go through the rest of the third journey, Paul will eventually make it to Jerusalem. He's arrested, goes to Rome. So Luke is sort of showing how God's path, where it will lead him, and it leads him to Rome, which is where we get to the end of Acts. And then, after we get that description, though, of course, Paul doesn't set off from Ephesus until what we'll see next week, but in 23 through 27, we'll see where in Ephesus the gospel disrupts and transforms. So 21 through 22, the mission the Lord directs, and then 23 through 27, the gospel disrupts and transforms. We'll see here in Ephesus this interesting situation with the silversmith. And he gets a little upset because he might lose some money. And you know how people are when they lose their money. They don't get too happy usually. And then lastly, in verses 28 through 41, which is a long, seemingly long passage, but it's a very brief reading in the sense of the action that goes on. But it's the unexpected deliverance. So the unexpected deliverance will take us from verses 28 through the end of the chapter, which is verse 41. So what you have is you have in the first two verses, 21 through 22, that is sort of a, I guess you might even say, one of Luke's summary type of statements where he's going to tell you the path or the route that Paul will endeavor to go on. And in the rest of the book, that's what Luke does. He describes how does Paul get to Jerusalem and then how does Paul end up in Rome. So that's what those verses will tell us. But then before Paul sets out of Ephesus in 23 through 27, the gospel is going to disrupt, but also we'll see where it transforms as well. And then even though Paul's going to have a lot of opposition through this silversmith, the Lord's going to use an individual there in the town, an unlikely, to deliver him. So before we read 21 through 22, if you remember, just in short, third missionary journey, Paul sets off from Antioch. And Paul's primary, not only, but primary reason to go back is to strengthen the churches. So he's not so much looking to plant new churches, as we might think, but he's going back to reinforce them spiritually. Again, doesn't mean that there aren't new converts, but that's what his main goal is. And he does some other things along the way. Before we read, though, verses 21 through 22, look at verse 20 with me one more time. And I think it might help. You'll notice it says, so the word of the Lord was growing mightily and prevailing. Basically, what Luke is saying there is that the gospel had spread at that point throughout the general province of Asia, Asia Minor meaning. So at that point, Paul has done a pretty good job, and of course there's others, but had spread the gospel at that point. So that means that Paul is going to begin to go somewhere else, okay? So that's sort of the idea of where we are. The gospel has primarily been delivered to Ephesus and in that general area there, but now Luke's going to provide for us what you might think of as the trajectory for the rest of the book. It shows us how and what Luke is doing, which is showing Paul's desire to go to Jerusalem and then eventually in Rome. You know, that was one of Paul's main things he wanted to do, was to get the gospel to Rome. And so that's what we're seeing here. Paul's goal to get to Rome, but in order to get to Rome, he's going to go to Jerusalem. And so it sort of gives us his, I don't like to use itinerary, but sort of. So let's read 21 through 22 here, the mission of the Lord, the mission the Lord directs. Somebody want to read those? Because 28 through 41 is the long reading. So if you plan to read tonight and you don't want to read a long one, now's the time.
Sure.
All right. Yeah, it's like everybody raises, everybody starts reading at once. Go ahead.
Okay. Now after these things were finished, Paul proposed and himself stayed in Asia for a while.
All right, so as we begin looking at this, of course, if you we don't really need the map for much for any reason tonight. We will, starting next week a little bit, it'll help. But Paul, and the scene here is Ephesus, okay? So nothing's really changed here. Now, when we begin looking at this, this is, again, the mission of the Lord directs here, and this is basically just, again, Luke's way of summarizing the fact that Paul will eventually go to Jerusalem, and then he'll end up in Acts, and that, in Rome, and then that's how the book of Acts ends. Now, let's start off, though. If you notice in verse 21, when Connie was reading, now after these things were finished, that means the story we saw last week, if you remember, about the demon who beats up the beats up those guys, somewhat modern vernacular there. But now after these things were finished, Paul purposed in the Spirit. Now, I want to stop here just for a second. Some take this spirit to be lowercase spirit, and some people will take it to be translated as uppercase. Most translations do uppercase. You say, well, okay, does it really matter? Actually, I would say no, but let me explain. Why would that make any difference? Some would argue if it was in Paul's spirit, Paul was sort of directing his own agenda. Does that make sense? Okay. If it was that it was uppercase, the Holy Spirit, it was that Paul was yielding to the Spirit. Okay. The way that I would say it to you is it's somewhat moot, because Paul always made plans, but whenever the Lord came along, he would go along and yield to those plans. So a lot of times people want to pit those two together, don't they? The problem is, if you look at the second missionary journey, what does Paul do? I'm going to go here. And he goes, and he's going, in a sense, almost to turn around and go east. And what does God say to him? That's great, Paul, but you're going west. And what does Paul do? Paul goes west, if you will, to use that as a simple way to think of it. And he takes the gospel into Rome. So Paul may have or may not have made plans. I would submit to you, Paul probably made plans. I mean, that was pretty normal for him to do. But the thing I would tell you is that regardless, Paul always yielded to the Lord. He always yielded to the Lord's direction. And that's the same thing with you and I. You know, you and I can make plans, and that God wants us to be planners. He doesn't want us to be laissez-faire. But what is the difference between planning and letting God lead is that you're flexible and you'll change. God sometimes will tell me, Stephen, you know, I'll have in my mind, you're going to preach something. And he's like, well, that's great. You're not doing that now. Okay, so just, we need to be flexible with God's plans. So my point is with that is, whether purposed in his Spirit, I think his Holy Spirit, ultimately it would sort of be six of one half, the dozen of the other. Okay, because even if Paul had decided, I'm going out to Mexico, and God says, that's great, halfway there, God changes it, Paul's going to go wherever God leads him to go. Proverbs 16:9 is a good verse with this. Because we tend to be humans, be extreme, don't we? He either went with himself or God led him. And if somebody says, which is it? I would say yes. Proverbs 16:9 says, the mind of a man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. So it's kind of a silly argument to begin with, okay? So the main thing is it's okay for us to plan. I would actually say God wants us to be planned within reason. We just need to be open to the Spirit redirecting those plans. You know the difference? So that's what we need to do. Now, moving on, what we see is, again, this is essentially going to show us the path to the end of the book of Acts. Paul had this desire to ultimately teach, to take the gospel to Rome, and this was not so much as a trip, as we might think of, as a mission to take Christ somewhere. What is the difference? You know, it'd be one thing to say, you know, I think I'd like to go see such and such. Okay, nothing wrong with that, right? Paul's not going to go on a sightseeing tour. Paul is going and desires to go to Rome, not to look at anything, but to take and bring Christ there. Okay, let's look at a couple of verses just real quick, and then we'll move on. Look with me in Romans, because we don't have to turn very far. You can actually see where Paul, his heart kind of bleeds out on some of these verses here. I'm just going to read a few of these. It's Romans chapter 1 and verse 15. Because again, just don't think of it as Paul's like planning this trip and he's going sightseeing and going on all the tours of Rome. Paul's desire is to take Christ, the gospel, there. So for instance, Romans 1, 15. So for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Paul just had this desire. One more spot, and it's at the end, Romans 15. Just so you can get an idea here. So this would also sort of counterbalance what we just looked at. Paul's heart was to do something, and the Lord, of course, would eventually guide him to go there. I'll just read verses 24 and 25. So this is Romans 15, 24 and 25. Whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing and to be helped on my way there by you, when I have first enjoyed your company for a while, but now I'm going to Jerusalem to serve the saints, basically there. Point is, Paul had a desire to go to Rome, and Paul's desire was not to be going on a sightseeing tour, but was to take Christ there to Rome. Now, you might think, okay, well, so what? Well, one of the things I think of with this is it shows Paul's heart to get the gospel to those who haven't heard it already. You know, Paul was big on not sort of going back and retreading old ground or ground someone else had gone on. Paul had a desire to get the gospel to people. And we need to remember, we can do many things at this church, outreach, but if the gospel isn't part of it, are we really doing what we should be doing? And you think of all the opportunities we have to share Christ when we leave this church. And we need to make sure that our priority is to do that, because Paul's heart wasn't to go sightseeing, but was to share Christ with people and to take the gospel. And that's what that's really showing us there, is Paul's heart. Now, in verses 23 through 27, we move on there, and then we'll connect next week this itinerary, this journey that Paul's going to go on. We'll reconnect there. But Paul's time in Ephesus isn't quite over. He's going to start a riot before he leaves. And that's the way to leave town, isn't it? All right, and had an exorcism last week, and now he's going to have a riot. And no wonder when you get to chapter 20, verse 1, Paul says, I think it's time we go.
Time to leave.
Yeah, so you'll be able to see that. So this is a little parenthetical here, but 23 through 27. So Ephesus, clearly the gospel has spread there. I mean, it's very clear. Paul has done a lot of ministry there at this point, and he's bearing a lot of fruit. And what happens when God's servant begins to bear fruit? Satan comes around, doesn't he? And Satan sometimes uses humans to do that very thing. So when we read 23 through 27, there is the silversmith who one might think he is sort of, let me honor this individual. We'll say it's obviously a false god in Ephesus. But really what you find out is his pocket or his purse is being impacted by the gospel, and he doesn't like it. So he begins to attack Paul. So 23 through 27, because the next reading is really long. Act now. All right, Sue. All right, so.
In the same time, there arose no small.
Interesting, isn't it? Thank you. All right, so we're going to look at this again, the outline, the gospel disrupts but transforms, 23 through 27. So when Sue starts off there, we'll see there we've got this scene after the sort of summary there with Paul. So in verse 23, it says, about that time there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way. All right, just as a reminder, what is the way? Yep, that was the early name for Christians. So this was an early reference to Christians. That's what they would have been called there. I think of John 14:3, right? I am the way. So it's a good way to think of that. Now, just for fun, and this will go ahead and take Dave's next Q&A question. Where in the Bible, when is the church first called Christians? Anybody remember?
Yeah.
Yep. Acts 11:27. So there you go, Dave. Next time you do a Q&A, I got you one.
I already used that one.
Oh, you already used it. Yeah, that's a good one to remember. So the way there, of course, just to be a little funny, that's, of course, referring to Christians. I am the way, I think of John 14:3, and the church, of course, first called in Acts 11:26. But moving on, we're introduced to an individual here at Ephesus, Demetrius, and Demetrius is a silversmith. And just from looking at this, you know, a couple of things we can discover about him. First is he was one of the leaders, apparently, one would imply. He was a leader of many of the craftsmen.
He was the head of the union.
Yep. Yeah, that would be the way to put it. Yeah, he would have been the head. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So he was head of union, according to Sue, and leader of craftsmen. We'll have to add that to the commentary. And manufactured, of course, think of it, silver shrines. Okay, so you start to put these pieces together and you begin to see what it is. Now, these shrines, these silver shrines that they manufactured, guess what they were used for? They were used related to, of course, Diana, meaning Artemis, and which is the false god that was there. And this was one of the main false gods that was worshipped there. So now you begin to see what this individual did for a living, and that's what made them prosperous. And people don't like that, do they? Now, at first glance, if you didn't know anything, if you think about it, you have to look at it from the context of the people there, because I think at first glance, Demetrius probably comes across as what? Well, I'm a concerned citizen. I'm worried about the honor of, again, this is a pagan culture. This isn't, a domesticated culture at this point in terms of Christianity. However, what we quickly find out is he's not so much concerned about her, meaning this false god, but economic reasons, money. And when money gets involved, people quickly change their tune. Now, let's look at these charges against Paul, because both of them, and I'm just going to summarize these, is they're basically two main charges. That's the thrust of them here. First is, if you notice, he actually, in many ways, contradicts himself or condemns himself or shows the validity of what Paul does, because he says Paul persuaded many people, and many people believe that message. So I think of, sometimes God's enemies ends up approving of or giving honor to that person. In this case, Paul, because, of course, it proves the effectiveness of the gospel, doesn't it? It's kind of curious the way he speaks, because Paul wasn't ineffective, but he was effective when he preached the gospel. So he says, look here, folks, Paul's message is lethal and it's effective, because it's true, he leaves off, but of course it was effective. Then, of course, he gets into one of the main things here, which is he's trying to say that Artemis's honor or was being dishonored. So Paul's message, of course, ultimately would have threatened their false gods. Do you think people like it when you mess with their idols and their false gods and all of that? No, not really. Notice in here, I'm just going to kind of touch on this because Sue, of course, read it. But notice it says that Paul comes and he turned away many people. So he's basically validating what Paul did, which was Paul was effective. But moving on, the second sort of charge, if you will, he says that Paul says that our gods were made with our own hands and they basically are worthless. So Paul's going to come in here and he's not only going to be effective, he's going to start causing problems for Artemis. And if Artemis and the statue and the worship is gone and the shrines are gone, I'm out of business. OK, Okay, so this is where this begins to turn. So this is idolatry. Paul's talking about the worthlessness, and he's afraid that Paul will begin to say that these idols are made by man. And if all of a sudden Paul gets really effective, these shrine creating business, I'm out of business. I got to find something else to do. Let's look at this idea of idols again. I'm going to look at two passages. You can turn with me. I'm just going to read them. Psalm 115. We're going to turn here, and you don't have to, but I'm going to read these because these ones are a little different because we may not think of turning to the Psalms. But Psalm 115, verses 4 through 9, I'll give you a little bit of some variation of verses related to idols. If anything, you know, one of the great sins of Israel was idolatry. I mean, that's one of the main reasons they went into exile. And there's so many verses related to this, but I'm going to read this because it does correspond to this. But Psalm 115, 4 through 9, their idols are silver and gold, the work of man's hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. They have eyes, and they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. They have noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but they cannot feel. They have feet, and they cannot walk. You get the point? They cannot make a sound with their throat. Those who make them will become like them, everyone who trusts in them. Sign me up. But then notice verse 9. O Israel, trust in the Lord. So what do those verses teach us? Verses 4 through 8, the worthlessness of the things that we create in terms of worship. Those things should never be trusted. They should never be relied upon. And unfortunately, that happens. And if you think about it, why would you want to worship something or have an object of something you might even call faith, if you want to call it that, that couldn't do anything to help you? And then you've got the creator of the universe and you're like, nah, I'm not going to bother with him. Let's look at another one here real quick. It's Isaiah. That one in particular, I've always thought was a helpful one. A little, I don't know, sarcastic maybe a little bit. But anyway, so Isaiah 44. We won't read all of these, but if you ever get an opportunity, this one is particularly helpful. And it's the NESB refers to the section as the folly of idolatry, which is a really good way to put it. But it's verses 9 through 20. So Isaiah 44, 9 through 20. And you can see the idea here. And just beginning reading, we won't read all of this. Verse 9, for instance, those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see and know, so that they will be put to shame. Who fashioned a god or cast an idol to no profit? And he goes on about the folly and the shame of following after idols. I just remind you again, idols are things or anything that takes God's place, either by usurping it or putting it on equal plane. You understand God does not do well when you put something on even equal plane to him. Everything else must be below him. You can have things that are even good things, or meaning, as I call it, morally neutral. But we must keep that in mind because that is, of course, a huge problem even today. Let's go back, though. So those verses there just show the idea of idolatry and the foolishness of it. And don't think that you don't possibly do that today, because there's a lot of things that aren't going to come help us on the day, are they? When we really need help, there's not going to help us. So anyway, so Demetrius, he makes these charges against Paul. He speaks of, ironically, the effectiveness of Paul's message, and he's afraid, well, if Paul comes in and is effective and continues to be this effective, I'm going to be out of a job. And of course, he's worried about that. But that's what we begin to see. What is his real reason? Why does he really go after Paul? And the real reason is verse 25, as I just said. These he gathered with the workmen. So this is, as Sue said, he's sort of the head honcho there of the union. And it goes in there and he says, men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. So what is he thinking? Is he looking really about the religious aspect, the honor of this false god? No, he's thinking about his pocketbook. And he's saying that my prosperity is at stake here. I want to just consider something and we'll move on to what happens. In Matthew 6:33, it says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and then all these things will be added to you," right? The idea here is we need to have a life where we desire to please God first, right? And then trust him to give us and provide for us those provisions. As we trust him, then of course we grow in knowing that he's going to provide for us. I think in this case, you know, think of the sadness of Demetrius. I'm just playing this out. Imagine someone who says, you know, even though Paul's very effective, I'm mostly concerned about my pocketbook and how it will affect me. The reverse of that is, again, Matthew 6:33, seek first God's kingdom and then God will add to you. Do you think that by following God, he's going to leave us without things that we need? No, of course not. But if we don't trust him, that's another story. J. Vernon McGee has this funny comment about this verse with Demetrius, and if you'd have to know him to know he's being a little flippant. He says, "You cannot step on a man's pocketbook without hearing him say, 'Ouch.'" But it should be that case for Christians, should it? But we should trust God and trust that he will give us the things we need. But I think a lot of times, you know, people think of surrendering their lives to God as what? Missing out. Missing out on things, right? And missing out on this shrine business. But what I'll tell you is the blessings God will give us if we follow him, they far exceed the shrine business, if you will, the silversmith business. Now, as we come to our final section, which I entitled in the outline, The Unexpected Deliverance, which is verses 28 through 41, I'll draw your attention to the fact that at face value, or at least on the surface, the opposition would probably seem at least to some degree insurmountable. You've got Demetrius, he stirred up individuals, and as we read through this passage, the whole city seems to be in almost a riot state. But the Lord will use an individual, an unexpected source, to try to help, and that deliverance will come. The Lord will provide it, and as he often does, he uses an individual we might not think of. So this should encourage us, I think, to know that the Lord is always at work, directing things sometimes behind the scenes so that his plans and his purposes will be fulfilled. For instance, if you think of Paul, we saw in verses 21 through 22 that Paul purposed in the Spirit. Now, Paul may have made some initial plans, but the Lord eventually directs him. The Lord will guide and direct him to Rome. We see that as we get towards the end of the book of Acts. But if he's going to get there, the Lord's going to have to deliver him from Ephesus in this chaos and confusion in the city. And the Lord's going to do that. And he does do that for his people, sometimes through expected means or sources, but sometimes through unexpected, which is what we'll see as we read verses 28 through 41. Having read those, let's look at some of this, and we see in verses 28 through 41 first, of course, the city's in chaos and confusion, probably a little bit of understatement there. A few things to note as we read the scene there, that the craftsmen have become enraged. So these are the ones that Demetrius, the silversmith, has stirred up. We also see that the city is in a riot state. But one of the encouraging things to note is that Paul is protected, at least to some degree. If you notice verse 29, Gaius and Aristarchus, those were Paul's traveling friends. Those names pop up in Colossians and also in Philemon. They are dragged away, whereas Paul, of course, seems to have been somewhat insulated. If you look at verse 30, some of the disciples protect him from going into that assembly there, assembly of the people at Ephesus. It's interesting, verse 31, it says, and also some of the Aristarchs there, those would be, verse 31, either religious or political officials. those ones were favorable to Paul and told him as well not to venture into the scene there that was going on with the confusion. So quite interesting there. So amidst the chaos, Paul is at least insulated to some degree, whereas Gaius and Aristarchus are not, sort of dragged off into the riot. But I'll mention to you that if you notice in verse 33 through 34, we have an individual's name pop up, and it's Alexander. Alexander in the text is Jewish, and it seems that he is going to try to intervene and to restrain some of this violence and to try to deliver Paul and his friends, or at least bring about a peaceful setting from this chaos. And we see that, and it's curious, he makes mention, Luke does, that Alexander motions with his hands, he wants to speak, but the people, they recognize that he is Jewish, probably assuming at this point that he's going to protect or speak on behalf of Paul. The city ends up shouting for 2 hours. It's a little bit amusing, I suppose, just because some of the people didn't even know what they were protesting. It shows how people go into madness very quickly. And seemingly here for 2 hours, Alexander's not able to speak. Now, I do want to mention verse 35. It says that after this, so once the 2 hours of rioting and shouting about greatest Artemis of the Ephesians, it says the town clerk speaks. Now, I will say there are some individuals, some commentators that equate the town clerk and Alexander as the same. Others see the town clerk as unknown. So in other words, it's just an unknown individual. So whereas Demetrius is a silversmith, Alexander is a Jewish individual. Some see the town clerk as just simply an unknown person. So just make note of that as you look at this. But this town clerk is a mayor, so we would think of it more in an official sense, which is where this authority comes from. Now, in this speech here, what we see is four particular things. First is in verse 35, Artemis is not man-made. This is the statement there. Now, whether or not that person believes that, the town clerk, whether it's the town clerk or maybe he and Alexander are one and the same, but nevertheless, the town clerk will say, states that Artemis is the image that fell down from heaven. Of course, that's just stating a fact there. That's actually what they believed. So the first thing to note is in this speech here, that Artemis is not man-made. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the town clerk says that Gaius and Aristarchus are innocent. Remember, they've been the ones dragged off. This probably also leads to the fact that Paul is eventually let loose. We'll see that next week. Then three, legal action. I like this statement because effectively what it says is that, look, if you want to press charges, there's a way and a means to do so. But I specifically would draw your attention to verse 40 because I would argue this is what ultimately stops the riot. Now, of course, God is behind this, certainly. But in terms of the text, look at verse 40. The town clerk here speaking says, "For indeed we are in danger of being accused of a riot in connection with today's events." The problem here is what is called the Pax Romana. This is the Roman peace. Effectively, what this is saying is, look, if we don't stop this chaos and rioting, the Romans will come in and stop it for us. I think this is probably the, at least, nail in the coffin, you might say. This is the final piece that it causes the chaos to stop, because then you'll notice in verse 41, it says, after saying this, he dismissed the assembly. So I think that that's the way to see that. So again, you have Alexander, who it tries to speak up, and then we have the town clerk speaks up. Are they the same person? Are these two individuals? Again, some suggest they're one and the same, but the reading of it does seem to be that the town clerk
is a separate individual. But nevertheless, the speech is made up of four things. He says that Artemidas is not man-made, that Gaius and Aristarchus are innocent. If they want to keep doing this, they need to instead choose legal means, and they also need to stop because the Romans will come in and put an end to it. I'm going to read you this from Harlow's Acts commentary, and he brings out the main point we need to see. Harlow writes, "It is good to know that God always has means of delivering his servants, even when situations appear bleak. Fear should never keep us from doing great things for God." In this passage that we're looking at today, verses 21 through 41 of Acts 19, what we see here is Paul yielding to the plans that the Spirit is directing him to. We also see where in Ephesus, the gospel does bring about transformation, but that transformation brings, unfortunately, opposition. But the Lord is able to deliver his people, and in this case, through unexpected means. William Cooper's hymn states, "God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. Ye faithful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head." So I would just close with the idea that the Lord does direct us and he does deliver us in a similar way today, but we too need to, like Paul, just simply yield to him.